Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next 2 half-hour segments, we're going to continue with a line of analysis that I've been presenting for, intermittently, I should say, over the last year or so, and in one form or another for the last several years, namely German corporate control of American opinion-forming media, and beneath that, and in particular, beneath that German corporate control of American opinion-forming media, controlled by what I call the Underground Reich and the residua of the SS, of the American publishing industry, which I think in many ways could be viewed as the key public opinion forming medium, in that what educated Americans are going to know about the world comes from the publishers of books, and what uneducated Americans are going to know about the world is going to come from educated Americans. One of the many Nazi-connected publishing firms, and a giant corporation it is, the third largest media conglomerate in the world, the largest publishing company in the world, and a dominant force, the single most important force in English language publishing at this time, is the Bertelsmann Corporation, which, as I speak, in December of 1998, continues to add to its already dominant American holdings on an almost weekly basis. As 1998 draws to a close, the euro is going to be introduced in 1999. German corporate interests are literally engaged in a blitzkrieg to purchase major American corporations. Part of that blitzkrieg was discussed in the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, December 15th of 1998, in a column that appeared on the front page of the business section. Once again, San Francisco Chronicle 12-15-98, page B1, actually page D1. This is a column by Mark Veverka, V-E-V-E-R-K-A, who writes a regular column called Street Smarts, and I may be mispronouncing his name. This is entitled, by the Chronicle, Amazon.com's German rival keeps pressure on America's top e-tailer. This column reads, in part, German media giant Bertelsmann AG continues to up the ante in its bid to supplant Amazon.com as the web's top bookseller. Bertelsmann Ventures of Santa Barbara, a venture capital fund of the Bertelsmann Group, is expected to announce today that it has taken a minority stake in Münchhoff and John's GmbH. Münchhoff is a German technology company that created ACSES, a well-known shopping service that searches the Internet to find the lowest book prices offered over the web. Terms of the investment were not available. Bertelsmann, which recently spent $200 million for a 50% stake in online bookseller BarnesandNoble.com, says it hopes that its stake in Axes, A-C-S-E-S, again, will keep at a pace of Amazon in the e-commerce race. Axes allows web users to shop the electronic aisles of some 25 Internet bookstores simultaneously, providing online shoppers with the lowest price available for a particular book. Shipping costs and delivery times also were included in the price search. In addition, the system can search the prices of several books at a time, gathering information for an entire electronic basket of merchandise. Thus, the buyer only needs to shop at a single website to find the lowest price for his or her total purchase. Naturally, the ability to shop for multiple products on various sites could become a huge factor as retailers such as Bertelsmann and Amazon continue to expand into broader merchandise categories. For its part, Amazon acquired a similar technology last August when it bought Jungle, J-U-N-G-L-E-E, which is best known for its ability to perform career searches on the web. And bear in mind that not long before this came out, Bertelsmann had, or BarnesandNoble.com, rather, had arranged with the Microsoft MSN network of Bill Gates to become the exclusive distributors of each other's online products. Bertelsmann had added the Springer Verlag Company, a German scientific publisher with very, very strong presence in the American market, 60% of whose profits are from English language publications. The foreign control, German in particular, of American scientific publishing, and the German corporate control of American publishing, and under that the Underground Reich and the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization that I've spoken about so many times is front and center. You can hear about those, the latest acquisitions, or those before this particular broadcast, in a pair of half-hour segments entitled German Corporate Control of American Publishing. That also recorded in December of 1998. Some of the Nazi antecedents, and antecedents is a very optimistic way of putting it, of the Bertelsmann Corporation, are discussed in an article that appeared in The Nation magazine. Research credit on the following goes to a member of the listening audience who got this off of The Nation's website. This is an article entitled, it's actually a selected editorial entitled Bertelsmann's Nazi Past. It's by Hirsch Fischler, F-I-S-C-H-L-E-R, and John Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N. And it is from the nation's website, and this particular issue can be accessed at www.thenation.com. And this is issue, after this it says /issue/981228. So I suspect that this would be the December 28, 1998 issue. I may be wrong, but in any event, this should be available, is available apparently on the Nation Magazine's website. And again, www.thenation.com. And this issue has /981228. So I suspect that's December 28th of 98. And again, this selected editorial, Bertelsmann's Nazi Past, by Hirsch Fischler and John Friedman, reads as follows. Skipping down, after a discussion of Bertelsmann's huge corporate holdings and their dominant role in American publishing, something that I've discussed in the pair of half-hour segments entitled German Corporate Acquisitions in the United States, that done in early 1998, and the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments about German corporate control of American publishing. After discussing Bertelsmann's huge presence in the American and other markets, the authors go on to discuss Bertelsmann's Nazi past. They write, Bertelsmann began to publish books during the early Hitler period that were used by Nazi propagandists. In 1934, for example, the firm issued a book seemingly intended for the brown shirts entitled Dr. Martin Luther's Little Catechism for the Man in Brown, edited by Werner Bethke, B-E-T-C-K-E, which praised Hitler and the Nazi movement. In 1936, Bertelsmann brought out a popular edition of People Without Space, or Volk ohne Raum, by Hans Grimm, G-R-I-M-M, an ardent Nazi supporter. The book was used to justify Hitler's expansionist attacks on Germany's neighbors. Throughout the 30s, Bertelsmann published bestsellers by authors favored by Goebbels' propaganda ministry, including P.C. Ettinghofer and Werner von Langsdorff. Such books glorified battles and death and primed the Germans for war. There were also patently anti-Semitic works like Hans Hoschen's Between the Vistula and the Volga, which asserts that Jewish civilians massacred Ukrainian women and children, and which contains pictures of forlorn men with beards above the caption, Jews look at you, unquote. In the late 30s and during the war, the publishing house printed Blood and Soil action stories by the hundreds of thousands for soldiers and young men. Titles included With Bombs and Machine Guns Over Poland, German Tanks Enter Hell, and We Broadcast for Franco by Helmut Führing, a propagandist for the Air Force Legion that bombed Guernica. Although difficult to locate today, well over 100 different titles were published by Bertelsmann in the 30s and 40s. The firm published many kinds of books during this period, including theological literature, a small portion of which was critical of the Nazis, and German classics of the 18th and 19th centuries. Shortly before Christmas 1939, Bertelsmann brought out special editions that could easily be sent by military post to soldiers at the front. These lightweight editions were so successful that Goebbels appealed to other publishers for such materials. Listen to this next sentence. Issuing more than 20 million books, Bertelsmann was the largest supplier to the Army and also supplied the SS. This last sentence again. Issuing more than 20 million books, Bertelsmann was the largest supplier to the Army and supplied the SS. In 1943, Bertelsmann, like most other publishers of religious works, was forced to close its Derufer theological division, but it continued to publish other types of books. In 1943, it was investigated by an army court for illegally procuring paper and profiteering, according to archival documents, and several senior executives were arrested in 1944. Parenthetically, I would note, as we reprised last week and as we also discussed, in the August 9th and September 20th installments of RFA 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War, it was in May of 1943 that the Nazi Party began to go underground in preparation for its post-World War II underground phase, and in 1944, those individuals and institutions who were to be utilized by the Nazis for their post-World War II underground Reich were officially given anti-Nazi histories or pedigrees so that they would qualify as opponents of the Hitler regime in the post-World War II period. That would give them a good cover to continue to perpetuate Hitlerism into the post-World War II period. We're going to review that in a minute. Note again this last sentence. In 1943, Bertelsmann, that is, was investigated by an army court for illegally procuring paper and profiteering, according to archival documents, and several senior executives were arrested in 1944. Heinrich Mohn, M-O-H-N, a member of the founding family of the firm as well as principal owner and chief executive, was not arrested. The executives were released after some months, and Bertelsmann continued in business. A Bertelsmann spokesperson says the firm was, quote, rendered inoperable, unquote. As indicated, in all likelihood, this was in preparation for Bertelsmann's use in the post-World War II period by the Underground Reich. Continuing. When Bertelsmann applied after the war for a second publishing license, it was turned down by occupation authorities. Mohn had forgotten, unquote, to mention that he had been a, quote, passive, unquote, member of the SS, as well as a supporter of the Hitler Youth, and a member of the prestigious National Socialist Flying Corps, according to denazification files in the Central State Archive in Dusseldorf. Note here that Heinrich Mohn, the head of the company, was a, quote, passive, unquote, member of the SS, according to his own description. That sounds rather like, to me personally, Bill Clinton's equivocation concerning having had sex with Monica Lewinsky. He doesn't consider oral sex to constitute sex. I certainly don't think that's an impeachable offense. But again, the concept of a passive member of the SS appears to me to be Clinton-esque in its originality and an exercise in equivocation under the circumstances. I never heard of a passive member of the SS, and it reminds me, going back to the Clinton-Lewinsky situation, reminds me of a Russian observer's comment that, quote, if the Americans don't think oral sex is constitutes sex, they're not doing it right, unquote. There were no passive members of the SS. This is simply foolishness. He may not have actually killed people with his bare hands, but the SS was anything but a passive organization. Continuing. In 1947, Bertelsmann wrote to the Allied authorities that because of illness and age, Mohn, then 62, was leaving as manager to be replaced by his son, Reinhard Mohn, who immediately and successfully applied for the license. Reinhard Mohn, who currently controls the majority voting power of Bertelsmann, was born in 1921. He served in the Luftwaffe according to denazification files. His vitae on a Bertelsmann website states that he was in the Afrika Corps. Der Spiegel reported he was in the elite Hermann Göring Division. I have seen references to the Hermann Göring Division as a Waffen-SS division. I don't know if that is accurate or not. But in any event, it is worth noting that whether it was SS or no, Reinhard Mohn was a member of an elite German military unit, the Hermann Göring Division. By the way, Licio Gelli was a liaison officer to that same division. And note that Heinrich Mohn, the head of the Bertelsmann firm, was SS. And again, it'll be interesting to see if I can find those references to the Hermann Göring Division, whether it is, in fact, Waffen-SS or another elite German unit, possibly Luftwaffe. It certainly is suggestive of an enthusiastic stance on Nazism by the younger Mohn, Reinhard Mohn, head of the firm today. And bear in mind that his father was not only in the SS, but that firm was the largest supplier of books to the Army and to the SS. The Nazi antecedents of Bertelsmann, and antecedents is probably a very optimistic term, currently in the line of journalistic discussion among the papers talking about that, the New York Times of Wednesday, 12/16/98, article by Dinitia Smith, that's D-I-N-I-T-I-A, headlined, Bertelsmann Plans Inquiry on Its Role During Nazi Era. Now, there are references to the Nation article that I just read you. The Nation article said that Bertelsmann was the biggest supplier of propaganda books to Hitler's army and the SS. And skipping down, speaking of Bertelsmann, and speaking of comments on that by some members, Mr. Middelhoff, one of their top executives, quote, but he said he did not know, speaking of Mr. Middelhoff, but he said he did not know whether all the company's divisions had been closed. That's divisions of Bertelsmann had been closed by the Nazis. Divisions here could be seen as something of a pun. Stalin once asked, in reference to the Vatican, how many divisions does the Pope have? I wonder how many divisions, in fact, Bertelsmann had during the war. Note again the controversy over Bertelsmann's role. It was closed down by the Nazis, or at least some of it was closed down in 1944 on an obscure charge. 1944 was when the Nazis were going underground in a big way, and in particular they were giving anti-Nazi pedigrees or anti-Hitler pedigrees to those individuals and institutions whom they were preparing to use in the post-World War II periods to perpetuate the Third Reich. And the greatest single political truth, perhaps, that one should understand is that the Third Reich did not disappear. It went underground, and it is as real in 1998 as it was in 1938, and a hell of a lot more dangerous now because people think it vanished long ago. That last, obviously, a bit of editorialization on my part. The definitive work on the Nazis going underground was written by a prominent or then prominent anti-fascist writer named Kurt Ries, last name R-I-E-S-S, the publisher of, among other titles, Total Espionage, The Self-Betrayed, and, of course, his classic, The Nazis Go Underground. That book was published in hardcover by Doubleday, Duran and Company, Garden City, 1944. Obviously, the book long out of print. I would note that Doubleday is now part of Bertelsmann. Speaking of the deliberate creation of anti-Nazi, anti-Hitler pedigrees for the individuals and institutions who were to be utilized by the post-World War II underground Kurt Ries writes as follows. This sort of thing has been going on for a long time. By the way, he, of course, was writing here in 1944 when The Nazis Go Underground is published. Again, by the way, before I read this, for more information about this, the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments about German corporate control of American publishing, as well as the August 9th and September 20th, 1992 installments of RFA 37, How the U.S. Lost the Second World War, the miscellaneous archive show Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce. Returning now to The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Ries, who wrote in 1944, this sort of thing has been going on for a long time. Several intelligence services have commented on the sudden disappearance of important personalities from political and party life, and it has become quite the accepted thing to everybody in Germany. But what has not yet become known is that all this applies to a much greater number of anonymous persons all over Germany, those on the second and third levels of the Nazi strata. These unknown personalities may be used later by the underground. Party functionaries who may be known locally but certainly not nationally can be easily transferred to another city or town where they will suddenly appear as anti-Nazis. The party helps in their masquerades. These men get new documents which, quote, prove, unquote, that they have always been anti-Nazi. Notes are inserted in their personnel files saying that they must be watched on account of their anti-Hitler attitudes and, quote, unworthy, unquote, behavior. Some of them will undoubtedly be sent to concentration camps for crimes which they have never committed, but which will make them look dependable in the eyes of the Allies. Some have perhaps already succeeded in joining anti-Nazi circles and are pretending to conspire against Hitler. Later on, they will be able to use such activities as alibis. And again, please note that, because that may very well have been the case, and in fact, the circumstances suggest that that was the case not only for Bertelsmann, but probably for the Mohn family, Senior Heinrich, a member, a quote, passive, unquote, member of the SS, and his son Reinhard, a member of the elite Hermann Göring Division, whether that was SS or no. I would note in this regard the very strong connections between Bertelsmann and the Thyssen AG company. That company was originally named Vereinigte der Stahlwerke. It was in one of the three giant German cartels that grew out of the American recapitalization of Germany at the end of World War II, and which not only supported Hitler's rise to power, but which comprised the backbone of German war-making industry, the other two being German General Electric, at the time 30% owned by American GE, and the very famous, infamous IG Farben company, about which I've spoken so many times. I would note that Thyssen AG is one of the giants of German heavy industry, also a major manufacturer of munitions. They are very closely connected to the Bertelsmann company, and we're going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. Before we get to that, however, I'm going to review a couple of key aspects of not only Nazi corporate policy, but German corporate policy as well. By the way, these two segments, the two I'm about to review, were accessed in a pair of half-hour segments entitled Tides of 20th Century Capital Flow that members of the listening audience should get a hold of if they want to flesh out their understanding of the dynamics I'm talking about in these two half-hour segments. For this, we're going to turn to a remarkable book that is still in print as I speak in December of 1998. That book is entitled The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. It's authored by Christopher Simpson and published in soft cover by the Common Courage Press and copyright 1995. What we're going to review here is the German corporate strategy that was pursued by the top Nazi industrialists and financiers in conjunction with Hitler, And that strategy involved the cooperation between German arms and German industry in such a fashion as German arms would be used to conquer neighboring nations, and that conquest then used to place German corporations in a favorable strategic position to govern those countries not only for the future course of the war, but after the war, regardless of the military outcome of the war. So German corporations would be in control of the occupied territories, even if the Germans lost the war. And this is this corporatist strategy for conquest is very important. It's a key to much of what we're going to talk about in the post-World War II period. Turning now to Christopher Simpson's The Splendid Blonde Beast about the German corporatist plan for conquest, we read, "In contrast, much of the banking and industrial elite of Germany favored a more traditional, imperial approach to acquiring a new empire in Europe. Among their principal spokesmen were Economics Minister Hjalmar Schacht, Hermann Abs, and a young Reichsbank director, Karl Blessing. Their strategy favored integrating businesses in countries occupied by the Germans into private industrial syndicates, coordinated through German-based cartels, and through private institutions such as Deutsche Bank. The private companies, in turn, pledged their loyalty to Hitler's government. German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprises in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices." Actually, let me reread this last sentence. "German military conquest should be used to create conditions through which German corporations could buy up the key enterprise in newly subjugated countries at very favorable prices," this faction contended. "But only in rare instances should the state take direct command of industry. Much of the senior leadership of the Deutsche Bank, IG Farben, the Siemens Group of Companies, and other German-based cartels maintained that Germany should re-enter the world marketplace rather than attempt to build up the orthodox Nazi dream of a self-sufficient German empire in Central and Eastern Europe." And this plan on the part of big German industry and finance to re-enter the global marketplace and to act in partnership with the German military so that the German military conquests acquired the corporations a favorable position in the occupied territories, regardless of the outcome of the war, is central to understanding the post-World War II corporate policy of the Underground Reich and also the foreign policy of the Federal Republic. Sticking with Chris Simpson's The Splendid Blonde Beast, what we're going to talk about now is the Himmlerkreis, or Himmler Circle of Friends. That was a group of powerful industrialists and financiers who financed the day-to-day operations of Hitler's notorious SS, and in turn got the pick of the slave labor pools and also had an inside track on aggrandizement through, quote, Aryanization, unquote, the appropriation of Jewish-owned business properties. And pay very close attention to what you're about to hear, because it's worth noting that the Himmlerkreis, or the Himmler's Circle of Friends, again, who the SS-connected component of German industry and finance, was basically in the driver's seat with regard to the reconstitution of the German economy in the post-World War II period. And bear in mind that these are the same industrialists and financiers who advocated the corporatist approach to German imperial power that eventually came to be the standard mode of German conquest, and which we just talked about, namely using arms to get a favorable position in the world marketplace and then re-entering the marketplace. Of the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler Circle of Friends, its role in finance and industry, and in particular its seminal role in determining the reconstitution of the post-World War II German economy, we read, "Senior business leaders active in the Himmlerkreis included Siemens General Director Rudolf Bingel, Unilever and Continental Oil Director Karl Blessing, steel industrialist Friedrich Fleck, Dresdner Bank's Karl Rascher and Emil Meyer, shipping and oil executive Karl Lindemann, and board members or senior managers from the Deutsche Bank, RKG, IG Farben, Krupp, and a dozen other companies central to the German economy. As the SS grew as an economic power, the SS members of the Himmlerkreis often migrated to new positions on corporate boards where they could secure government contracts and embody corporate loyalty to the regime. SS men and Nazi Party activists who made this transition included Wilhelm Kepler of the Braybag Brown Coal Combine and SS Enterprises, Fritz Kronefuss, Braybag Dresdner Bank, and Ritter von Holt, who joined the Deutsche Bank board." Again, prime exemplars of SS economic power. Bear that in mind because we're going to see the SS economic power reconstituted after the war in the position of the Bormann organization. And we're later going to talk about SS economic power in a speculative fashion as we review some sections of the book Serpent's Walk. Continuing. Officially, the Himmler-Kreis meetings were not for conducting business because that would have suggested corruption in National Socialist circles. As a practical matter, however, the encounters served as an informal coordinating point for German industry's negotiations with the SS on policy matters. I.G. Farben appears to have used Himmler-Kreis meetings to seek support for the company's vast forced labor complex at Auschwitz, for example. The companies represented in Himmler's circle became pacesetters in Aryanization, exploitation of concentration camp labor, seizure of foreign companies in the occupied territories, and similar business ventures that depended on SS cooperation. But as the war turned against the Third Reich, a number of business leaders in the Himmler-Kreis began to cooperate in clandestine and semi-clandestine contingency planning for the post-war period. Two of the best known of these groups were the Working Group for Foreign Economic Questions and the Small Working Group, and they were nominally sponsored by the Reichsgruppe Industry Association of Major Industrial and Financial Companies. They brought together Blessing, Rasche, Kurt von Schroeder, Lindemann, and others from the Himmler-Kreis with other business people such as Hermann Abs of the Deutsche Bank, Ludwig Erhard, then an economist with the Reichsgruppe Industry and later Konrad Adenauer's most important economic advisor, and I would add parenthetically his eventual successor. Ludwig Erhard succeeded Konrad Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany. Continuing, Ludiger Westrick, RKG Aluminum Industry and Non-Ferrous Metals, Philip Reimsma, Tobacco, Shipping and Banking, and with Nazi business specialists such as Otto Ohlendorf, the former commander of the Einsatzgruppe D murder troops, and Hans Kehrl, K-E-H-R-L, SS business specialist. A half dozen similar business forums emerged during the last years of the Third Reich. Most of these overlapped in membership, and all of them favored some variation of the corporatist strategy for empire articulated by Hjalmar Schacht, Obst, and others during the showdown over Aryanization in Vienna discussed earlier. And again, we've talked about the corporatist strategy for empire, which became the mode of operation for the Third Reich in the previous passage that we read from Splendid Blonde Beast. By the way, the Himmler Circle is discussed at considerable length in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the story of U.S. industrial cooperation with Nazi Germany. And Ludwig Erhard, bear in mind, succeeded Chancellor Konrad Adenauer as Chancellor of Germany. He was also the so-called architect of the German economic miracle, and as indicated here, he was a close and prominent working member of these Himmler-Kreis associated elements here, and they became the dominant element in post-World War II German industry. Before we conclude this segment, bear in mind a couple of elements of German corporate and governmental operations that are going to figure prominently in consideration of some of the things that we're going to talk about on the next side. Bear in mind that it's an important element of German law that no foreign corporation can own a controlling interest in any major German corporation. Again, this is an important element of German law and has actually helped to stall the MAI agreement. Not a bad thing in and of itself, but bear in mind that no foreign corporation can own a controlling interest in any German corporation. This basically gives those German super corporations that are buying up critical elements of other countries a profound national edge. Bear in mind that the members of the boards of directors of key German companies sit in on German government cabinet meetings. And bear in mind that German cabinet members sit in on the board of directors meetings of major German corporations. Those two aspects of German corporate and governmental life are unique. We'll talk more about them in our next segment. However, that's the end of this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.